Welcome to the Federal Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federal Society's Intellectual Property Practice Group, was recorded on Wednesday, November 6, 2019, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federal Society members.
Welcome to the Federal Society's telephone conference call. This afternoon's topic is a Courthouse Steps oral argument telephone on Allen versus Cooper. My name is Michael Wallen, and I am the Assistant Director of Practice Groups at the Federal Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Today, we are fortunate to have with us our panelist, Zvi Rosen, who is a visiting scholar and professorial lecturer in law at George Washington University School of Law, as well as Professor Josh Blackman, who is an associate professor of law at South Texas College of Law, Houston. We also have our moderator, Kevin Amer, who is deputy general counsel at the United States Copyright Office. After our speakers give their opening remarks, we will then go to audience Q&A. Thank you all for sharing with us today. Kevin, the floor is yours.
Thank you all for joining us today. We are here to talk about what I think is a very interesting case that was argued just yesterday in the Supreme Court, Allen versus Cooper. And the issue here is whether Congress validly subjected states to copyright infringement suits when it enacted the Copyright Remedy Clarification Act in 1990, or whether states are protected from copyright infringement claims under sovereign immunity. I'll give just a little bit of background on the case for those who aren't familiar with it and then turn it over to our panelists. This is a case actually that involves video and a photograph taken of a sunken pirate ship off the coast of North Carolina. It's the pirate ship of the famous pirate Blackbeard. And plaintiff in this case, Mr. Allen, took photos and video of the sunken ship. North Carolina, the state of North Carolina, subsequently posted some of these materials on its website. Mr. Allen filed suit against the state, bringing copyright infringement claims. The Fourth Circuit said that the state was immune, and there essentially are two arguments before the court that the petitioner, Mr. Allen, is asserting. The first is that there are two sources of constitutional authority that Allen's asserting here. The first is what we call the Progress Clause. Article 1, Section 8, Clause 8 of the Constitution is the authority under which Congress is empowered to enact legislation to protect copyrights and patents. It says to promote the progress of science and useful arts, Congress has the power to secure for limited times to authors and inventors the exclusive right to their respective writings and discoveries. And so the argument is that Article I authority is sufficient to allow Congress to subject states to liability for copyright infringement. The second argument is under Section 5 of the 14th Amendment, and that is that authority empowered Congress to abrogate state sovereign immunity for copyright infringement claims, and that, in fact, Congress did so when it adopted the statute at issue in this case, which is codified at Section 511 of the Copyright Act, which says that states shall not be immune against copyright infringement claims. So to start, I think I wanted to turn to Professor Blackman, who is going to give us sort of, a more general overview of the court's 11th Amendment jurisprudence in this area, sort of identifying some of the key points relating to the Article I argument, and then we'll turn it over to Zvi Rosen, who's going to, I think, dive more deeply into the specific copyright-related issues. So Professor Blackman, I turn it over to you to get us started.
Thank you so much. I am not an expert in IP, but hopefully I'll be able to shed some light on the court's somewhat complicated jurisprudence on sovereign immunity. As a basic matter, the 11th Amendment has been interpreted to mean that people cannot sue states. That's a general rule. But there are certain circumstances in which Congress can waive or abrogate a state's sovereign immunity. One way they can do this is pursuant to Section 5 of the 14th Amendment. The 14th Amendment was enacted after the 11th Amendment, and you could then use the 14th Amendment to eliminate sovereign immunity. But we have some difficulties here. The first is whether the the Patent Clause or the Intellectual Property Clause. The first question is whether the Intellectual Property Clause is a valid basis to waive a state's sovereign immunity. I need to walk you through a few cases that are relevant. The first case is called Seminole Tribe of Florida versus Florida from 1996. And this case held that Congress cannot abrogate sovereign immunity based on a statute enacted pursuant to the Indian Commerce Clause. That is, when Congress wants to regulate commerce between the Indian tribes and the United States, Congress can't use that authority to then abrogate sovereign immunity. There was some language, though, in Seminole Tribe that went even further. And the court in Seminole Tribe seemed to say that Article I as a whole cannot be used to waive sovereign immunity. Article I, of course, lists all of the powers that are enumerated, including the patent clause or the intellectual property clause at issue in this case. A couple years later, the court decided a second case called Florida Prepaid Post-Secondary Education Expense Board versus College Savings Bank. And this is a patent case based on the Patent Remedies Act. And Florida Prepaid also held that Congress cannot abrogate sovereign immunity through the patent powers. And you have this language in the Florida Prepaid case citing Seminole Tribe. And it says Seminole Tribe makes clear that Congress may not abrogate state sovereign immunity pursuant to its Article I powers. So far, so good. So far, the court's precedent seems to suggest that the provisions of Article I, Section 8, can't be used to waive sovereign immunity. But then we have another case in 2006 called Central Virginia Community College versus CATS. And this was a case decided in January of 2006, and it was a 5-4 decision. This was one of the rare cases where Justice O'Connor was in the court at the same time as Chief Justice Roberts. There's only about a 2-month gap, because as you all know, Justice Alito replaced Justice O'Connor. But during this brief period where Justice O'Connor was about to leave the court, she joined the court's progressives, and she joined the majority opinion by Justice John Paul Stevens. And the majority opinion in the CATS case sort of went in a different direction. The issue in CATS was whether Congress could waive a state's sovereign immunity pursuant to its Article I bankruptcy powers. Now, if you read Florida Prepaid and Seminole Tribe, they said, no, all the Article I powers are out. But Justice Stevens, he basically said that statement from Florida Prepaid was dicta, that the argument from Florida Prepaid was incorrect, that, in fact, there are some provisions of Article I that could be used to waive sovereign immunity. Now, I'm sure most lawyers know when a judge says that some old Supreme Court decision is dicta, that means they're simply going in a different direction because they had 5 votes. And O'Connor went with him, actually was about to retire. So the vitality of the CATS case is somewhat in doubt. Okay, that brings us to the present. The present case involves the Copyright Remedy Clarification Act of 1990. Did they get that one right? I didn't get that right.
That's right. Yeah. The CRCA, that's right.
The CRCA, yeah. So it's not RFRA, it's CRFCRA. The Copyright Remedy Clarification Act of 1990. And the question is whether this statute validly abrogated North Carolina's sovereign immunity from suit. And we have to then, the court then has to decide how to reconcile these different precedents. Florida Prepaid seemed to say that Article I powers cannot be used to abrogate sovereign immunity. And then the Central Virginia Community College versus CATS case seemed to suggest, no, we didn't really mean that. So at a minimum, we know that the patent element of the IP clause, the Constitution, doesn't work. But does the copyright element of the clause work? I will let Svi explain to you the differences between why copyrights and patents may be different for purposes of sovereign immunity. Okay, but that's the first element, right, of whether there's some Article I power at issue. The second thing we have to consider is Section 5 of the 14th Amendment, right? Does Congress have the authority then to abrogate the sovereign immunity? And here the relevant case is City of Burney versus Flores. It's a case from Texas. This was a complicated case that considered the constitutionality of the federal RFRA, the Religious Freedom Restoration Act. The case covered a lot of ground, but as relevant here, the court put forward a test, and they said when Congress wants to waive a state's sovereign immunity, they have to choose a fairly narrow remedy. They can't choose something that's too broad that becomes like a substantive piece of legislation. And in this case, when Congress was enacting the CRCA, they only found about 16 instances in which states were actually violating copyright. And one of the questions is 16 violations of copyright enough of an injury, a significant enough problem to justify the abrogation of state sovereign immunity. Okay, so those are the two big legal issues. First, can Article I, the Intellectual Property Clause, be used to abrogate? And second, was the record put together sufficient to justify abrogation under the test in Bernie v. Flores? I think I'll stop here and turn over to Sophie, who actually knows about IP law, who can explain to you what happened yesterday.
If I could just jump in, this is Kevin, and that was a very good overview. I wanted to just sort of drill down a little bit on the Article 1 point. So, I mean, as you indicated, you know, the issue seems to be kind of what do we make of this Katz decision, you know, and that's, do we sort of read Katz broadly for the proposition that, you know, to essentially overrule the Seminole Tribe case to the extent it said that Article 1 can never be a basis to abrogate state sovereign immunity, or is it, you know, is it limited to the sort of unique circumstances of bankruptcy? And there was some back and forth about that during the argument yesterday. Who do you think sort of has the better of the argument there?
I think this case is somewhat difficult to decide because these precedents are nearly two decades old. In the 90s, Chief Justice Rehnquist was very much pushing decisions that would find that states had sovereign immunity. And that was like a huge deal in the 90s. And that issue just sort of died. We just don't get much attention on this anymore. I don't know where Chief Justice Roberts is in this issue. Gorsuch didn't say a word yesterday, which is uncharacteristic. He did not say a word yesterday. So I don't know where the court is. I think the court will probably, if you had to ask a prediction, at least if not overrule Florida prepaid, say that sentence in Florida prepaid was not correct in its entirety. That's my prediction. But I think the Katz case probably was more accurate. But again, all the people who were in that opinion now are gone. So it's hard to predict.
And of course, another issue is that, you know, to what extent was the Article 1 argument squarely presented in Florida prepaid? There was some discussion yesterday of whether that was dicta. Is that right?
Right. That's correct. In the Florida prepaid case, this issue wasn't briefed. It was primarily a case about due process. They didn't even argue about the Article 1 intellectual property clause issue, which is why I think Stevens was perhaps justified in saying it was dicta. Although the lawyer for the photographer, Mr. Allen, basically said, if need be, we are just going to ask you to overrule Florida prepaid, at least that one sentence, which of course implicates stare decisis and other values like that. The court doesn't like overruling precedents, but that may be in the cards.
I'm going to turn to Svi Rosen, ask him to sort of pick up on this. And, you know, I guess I would kick it off just by asking you, we have sort of the background, a very helpful background on the kind of evolution of the court's 11th Amendment jurisprudence. How do these principles sort of factor in more specifically to the copyright arguments in this case?
Yeah, so I was going to say, it's so great to hear from an actual constitutional expert. I mean, this case has a lot of IP lawyers playing constitutional law, which is always dangerous. So I really appreciate Josh joining us on this. I'm sort of reminded of the old joke, whether it's a copyright clause or a patent clause, depends largely on who's paying the bills. So this whole controversy goes back close to 40 years, about 35 years. The Supreme Court decided the Atascadero case in 85, and you started seeing all of these decisions questioning whether or not there could be a lawsuit against a state. And you have a very large number of lawsuits against states for copyright infringement in a short time. And this leads the House Judiciary Committee to ask the Copyright Office to do a study, and they ask Ralph Ullman, who was registrar at the time, and who was actually able to be at the argument yesterday, which was really, really nice to see, to prepare a report on what the volume, whether there was a problem, should there be a solution, and sort of a situation. And they get about 40 comments from a lot of the, pretty much all the major interest groups, and they put out a study in 1987 that really explores the issue and says, hey, this is a problem, and Congress should deal with it. And then Congress, of course, picks up into its own assembly of a record and says, yes, we're going to enact the Copyright Remedy Clarification Act. We're going to keep it as simple as possible and just say that, yes, it is copyright infringement, that states have the same liability as everyone else for copyright infringement, essentially. So sort of on the bandwagon of that, the Patent Remedy Act was passed. The Patent Remedy Act did have a much shorter record, and I think it was largely pass on a basis that, oh, well, if they have for copyright, why not patent? And the record, as I understand it, was substantially lighter for a Patent Remedy Act. And then, of course, a Patent Remedy Act is one that ended up before the Supreme Court in Florida prepaid. But so there's a situation where the Copyright Remedy Clarification Act has been of some doubtful constitutionality over the past few years. I believe a Solicitor General has refused to defend it, et cetera. But there's been a continuing problem of states which are infringing copyrights. There's a couple of amicus briefs in there from Copyright Alliance did one, and a couple of others as well. They're all on the SCOTUS blog docket site of continuing problem. And this particular case, as Jose said, is about the ship Queen Anne's Revenge, which was built around 1710, and Blackbeard captured it in 1717. Captured a bunch of ships, or made his notoriety that lasted today. And then this company, Intersol, had a permit from North Carolina to film the wreckage, and he hired Alan. Alan is a commercial photographer and videographer to film all the wreckage. And the state of North Carolina used it, and Alan protested, and basically had a settlement agreement whereby North Carolina would stop having the material online, and any material they did use had to have a watermark and a few other things. And when the state of North Carolina stopped displaying these, Alan sued for violation of his copyrights. It's kind of an interesting case in that the copyright elements aren't really in doubt. There was some vague allegation of fair use in that, you know, it was generally for educational purposes, this wreck of a ship, and there's also some general mentions that, you know, the ship itself was property of the estate. So there are some general allegations of that, but those aren't really at issue in the case, partially because of the procedural posture of it is at a motion to dismiss stage. So all of Alan's allegations are treated as true, and the court is just looking at the underlying constitutional law issue. Oh, and I should mention, in addition to continuing to use it after a settlement agreement, the state passed a law, which was called Blackbeard's Law, and at argument, Judge Sotomayor said several times she was very concerned about this. This law said that all pictures and videos of wrecks in the waters of North Carolina are public records of the state and are thus public property and not subject to copyright, which is a really interesting and funky law. And I actually think it dovetails a little bit with a case that's being heard next month, which is a little different, which is the public resource case about copyright and state edicts. You know, state edicts and public records are not quite the same thing, but the conversion of these copyrights to public records definitely rubbed Judge Sotomayor the wrong way and sort of had a funny feel to it. And so there's a few other issues. I think there's the allegation that there's also a breach of contract case going on because they had a settlement agreement, and that's in North Carolina State Court. So there are a couple of interlocking actions in this case, but there's not really much question that the copyrights, which are of this wreck and were taken by Alan, are valid copyrights. The question really is whether or not he has any ability to enforce them. And if he can enforce them, does he have his exclusive rights been secured in them?
And that's very, very helpful. So let's sort of, we talked before about the argument under Article 1, the Progress Clause. You sort of focus more on the Section 5 of the 14th Amendment piece. So let's sort of look at that a little bit more. So obviously we talked about the Florida prepaid case, and for those, you know, who aren't familiar with it, as was indicated, that was a case involving whether Congress properly abrogated state sovereign immunity under the Patent Reform Act. And so in that case, you know, the court looked at, you know, applied the standards for abrogation under the 14th Amendment, which involves a few elements. You know, the first is Congress has to clearly indicate an intent to abrogate. It has to identify constitutional violations, and the remedy that it chooses must be congruent and proportional to the violation. Now, in Florida prepaid, this is a difficult precedent, obviously, for the petitioners here, because the court in Florida prepaid held that The record essentially was inadequate in the context of the Patent Act to abrogate. So, you know, a question here is there something different about copyrights? Is there, and I think that there's sort of two parts to that, and I'd like your views, both of you, but particularly Zvi. Number one, is there anything, you know, there was some back and forth yesterday about whether there is anything different about the record leading up to the CRCA, the Copyright Remedy Clarification Act. Is there anything, was there, you know, a greater showing of constitutional deprivation going on in that context? And then maybe a more interesting sort of legal question is there something different about copyrights compared to patents? The petitioner's lawyer made an argument in that respect, and I wonder, you know, if you could elaborate on that.
Yeah, sure. So I'll actually answer the second one first. Is there anything different generally? Then I'll look at the actual records. In terms of general differences, I think the answer is there absolutely can be a difference. In fact, I don't know if a court will find it to be enough, but yeah, a patent is a fairly short grant of monopoly in the idea, sort of the invention, that, and thus you can easily infringe a patent without knowing it. In other words, if you come up with the same idea a year later and haven't been looking and just start using it as a state, you could potentially be infringing it and not knowing it. On the other hand, on the copyright, because copyright infringement is a multi-step analysis. It requires access to the copyright, well, very different standards, but to the local version is access to the access, actual copying, and actionable copying, which is, say, more of a de minimis copying. So you have to have all three of those. Access and actual copying both pretty much preclude sort of unknowing copying. You might think you have a legal remedy for it or something like that, but you can't do it without having any knowledge of the other work. You have to at least know that a previous work exists that you're copying. And that's a fairly substantial difference in that if you see a photo, you might not know copyright law or something like that, but you do know that it's a photo. And if you know it's in a copyright law, you know that copyright is going to attach to it. So the fact that you're very unlikely to have completely accidental infringement of a copyright, you know, it may not be willful, but it's very unlikely to be unknowing.
Sorry, we should clarify. So how is this relevant to the constitutional analysis, going to this question of whether negligent deprivations by a state can rise to the level of a constitutional violation? That's the issue, right?
It's very hard to have a completely accidental. And the question is, what percentage is willful, intentional, negligent? And the court is throwing around that perhaps 80% of them are intentional, which I think tracks pretty well with what most people's assumptions would be about it, although it's hard to know for sure. I know the concern of some, like the university libraries, is that things that they believe are fair use will become much more difficult because there's a specter of liability they wouldn't have before if they don't have sovereign immunity. But yeah, essentially that's how it would affect it, that, you know, to the extent the constitutional standard involves has a sort of proportionality and intent component, the fact that copyright is harder to infringe unintentionally is definitely a way to distinguish them. And I just wanted to hop, and I think it'll be good to have Josh weigh on this as well, but I just wanted to hop briefly to the record. And I'm actually curious what Josh thinks about this as well, that I think the record of the actual congressional hearings on the CRCA is fairly short, but there's also a much longer Copyright Office report with many more examples, which was prepared a few years earlier. And I actually wonder if that's considered part of a record of a law, and I wonder if the fact that the Copyright Office is a legislative agency affects that at all.
Thank you, Zvi, for that the helpful discussion. When we're talking about Section 5 of the 14th Amendment, we are often asking the question, is the remedy that they proposed congruent and proportional to the injury to the states, right? In other words, we are allowing people to go after the states for monetary damages, right? Is the sort of injury that people are suffering, does that justify allowing the state's sovereign immunity to be waived? The leading case we have here is called Bernie versus Flores, in which case Congress opened up every state for monetary damages if the state imposed certain burdens on the free exercise of religion. And the court said that that was not enough, that the record of states violating religious freedom was too slight to enable this wide-ranging abrogation of sovereign immunity. The facts in this case may be a little bit different because it's a fairly specific type of violation, not just a broad violation of free exercise, but certain types of infringement on copyrights. Even still, you still need a record to show how big of a problem this is. And the record that was prepared for Congress showed, I think, 16 violations. The lawyer for Allen argued that these 16 were just a tip of the iceberg, and many were repeat violators. During the arguments, a few colorful exchanges came up. I think Justice Breyer asked, you know, what happens if a state made its own, you know, Netflix, where they would just stream Captain Marvel and Spider-Man, these other movies, and they would charge people $5 for them and say, okay, you guys, you can't sue us. So it's possible that Congress didn't anticipate those issues that would arise given modern technologies. And can the court bootstrap, say, well, based on present-day circumstances, we can then go back, or is it merely retroactive? Another issue that came up is the fact that North Carolina enacted something called Blackbeard's Law, which is this insane law that says these pictures are public domain and they can't give rise to any sort of copyright liability. And Justice Sotomayor was very upset, saying, how can you pass a statute saying we can willfully violate this guy's copyright? So I think North Carolina loses this one, but I don't quite know how the court looks at the records and other sorts of issues.
The hypothetical that Justice Breyer raised, I think, implicates an interesting question that I think the court was grappling with yesterday, and that is, it seems clear that and I believe even the lawyer for North Carolina agreed that Congress has the power to provide a remedy for intentional deprivations of property. In the example that Justice Breyer gave, the implication seemed to be that if a state, was intentionally streaming movies from its website, to the extent that this statute only reached that sort of conduct, North Carolina seemed to agree, as I take it, that would be constitutional. I think a question that is unresolved is, to what extent does this sort of analysis require a case-by-case analysis? In other words, Justice Kagan raised the question, suppose Congress, as Svi, you indicated, decided that, say, 80% of copyright infringements involve some level of intentionality. Is that enough to, abrogate sovereign immunity and to free courts of the obligation to sort of undertake a case-by-case analysis to determine whether or not states are immune, or do you have to sort of look individually at each individual case to determine whether a constitutional deprivation is being alleged?
I think it's kind of a funny situation. I think this was something that certainly counsel for a petitioner want to focus on, is that, listen, I can imagine the Supreme Court saying whatever it wants. If it says that this is unconstitutional, if the infringement is willful, so it would be. And I do think that my impression is that most of the examples that have been given, like something like showing movies in a prison, is pretty clearly willful infringement, assuming you don't pay for it, obviously. And so I think, if that's where they draw the line, I think that would be doable. I think requiring every single case be a case-by-case analysis of the constitutional factors would very quickly become a tremendous burden on small claimants. I mean, Allen is not a large atom operation. Allen is not a large operation at all, and I think it'll be a very just in terms of the barriers to getting a recovery, it would immediately raise them substantially if we're going to require that in a case-by-case basis in every case. But, that would certainly be one way to do it.
There also seemed to be concern, I think, expressed about some of the equities here. Justice Ginsburg indicated, I think she said there was something unseemly about the idea that states should be free to hold and enforce copyrights of their own, but immune from liability. I wonder if you noticed that as well and had any reactions to sort of how the kind of equitable considerations may be relevant to the court here.
Yeah, I think North Carolina really didn't put its best foot forward in this case. And I think that's never, I mean, you never know, but I think in copyright cases, the party perceived as a bad actor often has trouble. They did make clear that the, you know, the Department of Antiquities for the state has a tiny budget, has to have priorities, and wants to do it, and has to do education on for the whole state on that budget as well as everything else. And allowing these sort of lawsuits could cripple it. But they, I think the law was the Blackbeard's law especially was kind of a bad look at that a number of justices found problematic. And I can certainly imagine a decision that sort of says, look, this is sort of this is a state declaring a state statute that free and clear to infringe copyright. And that might provide a hook to give a limited decision that goes for Allen without making a dramatic federal federalism decision.
Professor Brockman, do you agree?
I think the equities here are somewhat tough, and there might be a way for the court to duck it. The lawyer for North Carolina suggested that this may not even be a copyright dispute, that this may actually just be a dispute about whether the state is complying with this sort of settlement agreement they reached some years ago. And the court may just duck this case altogether because it's sort of obscure. And depending what the court holds here, it could have some sort of very broad implications for other areas of intellectual property. So maybe even get a dig, or maybe they just rule on some sort of narrow ground. I just get the sense this is not the sort of case where they want to overrule a precedent and invoke stare decisis. It's a weird case. It's a fun case. There may be reasons not to get to a sweeping ruling with these facts. This issue cannot come up very often.
That actually reminds me of one last question I had thought of before, and then I'm going to open it up to questions from the participants. One additional issue relating to the Article 1 point and cats is, you know, to what extent, and I alluded to this before, you know, to the extent that cats cast doubt on or overrule the more general statement in Seminole Tribe about Article 1. Is there a concern that would then sort of require a kind of case-by-case individual analysis of individual clauses within Article 1 to determine whether that clause provides a basis for abrogation? In other words, you know, I think the lawyer for the petitioner in this case made an effort to really say, you know, the progress clause is distinct within Article 1 and that it intellectual property rights, the right to enforce these federal rights is something that, you know, is separate from the other Article I powers. I wonder if there is any concern, you know, I wonder if the court, what your reactions are to that argument, if you think the court bought it, or if there's if you see a concern potentially on their part that sort of analysis you'd potentially undo some of its earlier 11th Amendment jurisprudence.
If we get rid of the broad prohibition from Florida prepaid, that all of Article I's out, then you do need to see this case-by-case decision that this clause and this clause and this clause. Maybe that's the right answer, because maybe some clauses in the Article I are stronger than others. But I think that would create some uncertainty in the lower courts. And this is really the first time the Roberts Court weighed in on this issue. The last case, again, was Katz, was from 2006. So it was decided in a brief period between Sandra Day O'Connor and Sam Alito. Actually, I checked the date. Justice Alito joined the court on January 31st. This case was decided January 23rd. So this was the last 5-4 opinion that Sandra Day O'Connor put her name on. And, you know, if this case came out a week later, I don't know if it comes out the same way. So I don't know if they're going to endorse Florida. I'm sorry, if they're going to endorse CAP. That may not be in the cards.
So I think we have about 20 or so minutes left, and so I would like to turn it back over to the FedSoc folks to invite questions from the audience.
Not seeing any questions light up the queue at the moment. Kevin, I will toss it back over to you.
Well, don't all volunteer at once. Svea Rosen, I wonder if you had any thoughts about the question I just asked about, you know, about cats. I know you focus more on the 14th Amendment piece, but you know, what did you make of the argument that cats really should cause the court to revisit, you know, Seminole Tribe and Florida Prepaid?
Well, the question is, you know, I mean, are we going to treat Florida Prepaid as sort of a blip or sort of a expression of core doctrine? In other words, is a problem with Florida Prepaid that they really didn't do the Patent Remedy Clarification Act right? Or is the issue that more fundamental than that? Because everyone seems to agree that the record, I think there's a line was really terrible, something like that, in the patent remedy context. The record of the copyright remedy law is much more detailed, and I think the patent remedy law was really sort of tacked on following the success of the copyright law. And I really don't know which way they'll go on that. Josh is more knowledgeable than I am about the con law, about these sort of broader trends in con law. I think it's a question of whether the court is more concerned about protecting Seminole Tribe or in terms of state or in terms of the underlying concerns about copyright infringement. It's an interesting discussion as to what secure exclusive rights means if there's no remedy. And it's kind of an interesting question because you have this weird usage in the IP clause. Congress shall have the preamble to secure exclusive rights for limited times to authors for their writings. And if Congress doesn't have a right, it's not an exclusive right if there's no remedy, is one way to put the argument. And I think sort of argument that was being argued, that if there's really, you know, you have a constitutional power to grant exclusive rights, and if exclusive right has no remedy, then that power has sort of been written out in the context of states. And I do wonder if that's something the court might want to pursue. It would also be a nice way to avoid breaking broader jurisprudence, so to speak, because it's limited to the language of the IP clause.
Yeah, and I think that's an important point, and it's one that the petitioner's counsel really focused on, you know, that there is something distinct or that the IP clause really does contemplate, you know, enforcement against all infringers, and that it is distinct within Article 1, you know, and you're right, he did focus on, you know, the term secure and exclusive rights, and, you know, the argument is that it would be a little odd to conclude that these rights could be that states would be free to infringe, and yet you know, you have this constitutional text saying secure exclusive rights.
And I also I'm happy to give one more point while we wait, which is there's a number of interesting projects going on now where state universities are innovating in the space of things like controlled digital lending that may or may not be permissible under copyright. And I think being under the umbrella of sovereign immunity of the 11th Amendment is sort of giving them cover to do that. Not exclusively, but I think it's probably part of a calculus. And I think that's probably part, I mean, it's interesting to have it sort of lurking in the background. I don't think it was in any of the briefs and anything like that, but I do think it's definitely on the mind, certainly of the amici on the state side.
And this is Micah with the Federal Society. I'd just like to say there's still no questions coming up through the line, so Kevin, I'll leave it up to you, but feel free to ask for closing remarks from our panelists if you believe we've covered everything.
Yeah, I first would like to thank you both for participating. I think this is a very, very helpful overview. And I don't have any further questions for either of you. So if either of you do have brief closing remarks, maybe predictions, feel free to share them now.
Sure. This is Josh. My only hope is that the pirate puns aren't too bad in the opinions. We do have to teach these cases. And in general rule, puns always sound better in your head than in the U.S. reports. If you're listening, law clerk. Hint, hint.
Josh, if they listen to one thing from this, I hope it's that.
Sure.
I'm really excited to see what comes out. I mean, it's gonna be interesting. I mean, this has been an issue of a copyright role I've been grappling with in various ways for 30 to 35 years. And, you know, there's been a lot of work on it. And I think there's sort of, at a minimum, I think having a certain finality over a Copyright Remedy Act will be good, one way or another. At a minimum, I hope for that.
All right, and on behalf of the Federalist Society, I'd like to thank all of our experts for the benefit of their valuable time and expertise today. We welcome listener feedback by email at info@fedsoc.org. Thank you all for joining us. We are adjourned.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.